Oh, there's one.
Oh, wow.
Oh my god, oh my god.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
Did you really think this out?
Hi.
I mean, there's no rhyme or reason.
It's just, I don't know.
Okay, you with me? Welcome to Essential Salt from Maine Public Radio. I'm Jess Miller, one of the people who makes Maine Public Radio, and I love a good mystery. I mean, who doesn't? The stories you're about to hear in this episode are both mystery stories. The first is about something that's supposed to be here, but then suddenly disappears. The second is about something that's not supposed to be here at all, but it suddenly arrives. In each case, there's a kind of quest to uncover the motives that set a very unusual series of events into motion. The reporters in these stories ask really big questions about what makes something valuable, who gets to be the judge of what is valuable, and who gets to own something that's ultimately priceless. And in the end, we'll find out a little bit more about what it means to welcome someone or something new to Maine, which is a serious responsibility that we all share. First up, we have a monster heist story. Natalie Gregory explains that back in 2013, a huge robbery had police and maybe even the people who perpetrated the robbery doing a kind of double take. This is Wyo Wyeth, Natalie's piece from 2020.
We get our burglaries, but not $15 million of oil paintings. It'd be like stealing a car and then realizing you stole, like, a Ferrari. You know what I mean? Like, you think you get $100 for it, then you realize it's a $1 million car.
On May 7th, 2013, Portland police received a call about a burglary in Monument Square. The residence belonged to local real estate tycoon Joe Soli, one of the biggest property owners in the city, and, according to the Portland Press Herald, a landlord with a history of disputes with the city and his tenants. Perhaps this notoriety made him a natural target for local thieves, since the burglary in question involved the theft of 6 paintings from Soli's downtown apartment. But these weren't just any paintings. These were original illustrations by revered Maine artist N.C. Wyeth, valued at around $36 million. According to Lieutenant Nick Goodman, there was one officer in particular that was suited for the case.
Detective Gorham, she's a rock star. So she got assigned the case. We're like, oh, she'll find them. She finds everything.
Detective Kelly Gorham has been with the Portland police for nearly 20 years. She's tallish, with curly brown hair, and total badass energy.
A lot of people say I'm tenacious, and I'm like, yeah, like I'm a pit bull, a bloodhound. You're going to just work until you find it. And this was exciting. You're like, I have no idea about art, but as soon as you tell me $36 million, I'm going to educate myself.
Detective Gorham had just finished her shift when the call came in.
I had just left the office. So I remember getting called back in, and McGarry, our sergeant at the time, was just like, Kelly, this is going to be your case.
So what were these famed paintings? And who is N.C. Wyeth, you might be wondering? Newell Converse Wyeth was one prolific dude. In the early 1900s, his work appeared in Harper's Magazine, and he also illustrated Coca-Cola posters. But he was probably best known for his work in Scribner's classic books, books like Treasure Island and Robin Hood. Anyway, Detective Gorham walked me through her initial thoughts when the first few officers arrived on the scene.
I mean, there's no signs of forced entry. Okay, there's a little shimmy in the window. You could have popped in here, but we're thinking to get those huge paintings out the back, it was nearly impossible. So we were thinking somebody had to know somebody to let somebody in.
So no break-in. And according to the police report, Joe Soli stated that besides himself, only 2 other people had master keys to the building, his grandson and a maintenance worker.
And to carry these paintings out, we said that it would take some strength and you would need one of those transportation vans, so to speak. You're not going to throw them in the back of a car seat. But you know what's not unusual? Deliveries are made there all the time. people bring all sorts of vehicles up there to make deliveries to all the businesses right there.
Detective Gorham started telling me about some peripheral criminal activity happening down in Old Port, Portland's touristy historic district, not far from Soli's apartment. She also mentioned a colorful character named Paul Matarisi, who was suspected of knowing about the art.
Matarisi was bad, bad news, like a big criminal from down in Boston. And he was up here in his velour sweatsuit, and he was doing the same thing. They were all slinging drugs.
So who was the mastermind? And was there some larger criminal outfit at play?
You don't know. Who was the one that said, like, there's paintings up there? Matarisi, he goes home and shoots his mouth off in Boston, and, you know, mafia still exists, right? Old school somewhere.
Certain people were implicated, including Paul Matarisi and George Noonan, Joe Soli's maintenance manager. Noonan had a history of felony drug charges, but there was no concrete proof that linked him or Matarisi directly to the theft. This was one of the biggest property thefts in Maine history, so it caught the attention of the FBI, who eventually got involved. But things got quiet for a while. For her part, Detective Gorham wrote up a report detailing the paintings and the theft, and sent it out to federal, state, and local law enforcement. But what really compelled thieves to steal Joe Soli's prized paintings? Just money? Or was it some art-loving mob boss down in Boston? I had a hard time believing that they did it because they appreciated the dark color choices and vivid composition of Wyeth's work. Joe Soli, on the other hand, sort of disagrees. I spoke to him on the phone.
Well, obviously, it's something that must mean more to them than the value of the painting alone. Now, I recognize that these paintings' values have gone crazily high, but it was more than the monetary value. I think that somebody who steals a painting has maybe an awkward kind of love for the work, too, and really must at some point want to enjoy them personally. And that's what I tried to get across to the FBI.
I asked Joe which of the stolen paintings was his favorite. He didn't hesitate.
Probably Encounter at Freshwater Cliff. That was part of Treasure Island.
The Encounter on Freshwater Cliff, like a few of N.C. Wyeth's paintings, is both violent and enchanting, all at the same time. It's full of shadows and depicts a very menacing scene.
Well, it's pretty grueling, but it shows a guy bent over the edge of the cliff with the falls below, and he's about to thrust a long sword right into this other guy's gullet. He's also knocked out another guy that you can see on the sideline. He would capture what was going on in those books so dramatically that it just drew me into his work.
I asked Detective Gorham about what these thieves were potentially after. Was it money, or was it pure enjoyment, some sentimental value?
They stole it, right? Did they steal it for someone down in Boston that wanted the art and they really loved it and wanted it on their walls? Or, you know, the other part is they stole it, somebody that was maybe not the higher-ups of this chain of drugs and money and laundering or whatever, and then they go out and sell it. It's so crazy to theorize both ways because it could be both.
In other words, we still don't really know. But one thing is for sure, the value of art is up for interpretation.
Its value is only as much as, like, in the eye of the beholder, right? For you and I, well, I didn't find it, like, this fascinating art, right? I was kind of like, wow, that's dark and that's kind of morbid. But Mr. Soli Joe, he's like, that's art.
In the end, all six paintings were recovered. Detective Gorham's original report actually helped track some of them down. In November of 2014, a Texas trooper pulled over a Mercedes. The driver was let go, but not before the trooper noticed paintings in the back of the car. The FBI then traced the Mercedes to Southern California. Four of the six stolen paintings were found in a pawn shop in Beverly Hills. The other two paintings were recovered a year later, anonymously returned to a retired FBI agent in Boston. One of those returned paintings was none other than the Encounter on Freshwater Cliff. The paintings were recovered, but there are still certain mysteries surrounding the case, like who physically stole the paintings from Joe Soli's apartment. None of the men prosecuted were convicted of the actual theft. They were convicted of things like transportation of stolen property and using stolen property for securing a loan. And they didn't talk, which means we still don't know how the paintings left the building. Before returning back to Joe Soli, the paintings were celebrated in a special show at the Portland Museum of Art.
Oh, it was incredible. We were over 150 people at the museum. We just talked and gathered with the paintings all around on the walls. And it was a real jubilant, wonderful thing. And I really feel that we are just so lucky to have some of this work.
I like to think Wyeth would be proud that his paintings inspired such drama, the epitome of life imitating art.
That was Why, O Wyeth by Natalie Gregory from 2020. Natalie tells us there haven't been any significant updates on the theft since she first reported it. In December 2024, Joe Soli passed away at age 93. Natalie went on to co-found Audio Monuments, which she describes as personal audio documentaries commemorating people and events. Okay, we're going to keep things rolling with an epic journey from the Amazon to Deering Oaks Park in Portland. Neroli Price sets out to understand the legend of an unlikely traveler who swooped into town one November and captured the imaginations of people across the state. Also from 2020, this is Odd Bird.
I'm going to do a thing called pishing, P-I-S-H-I-N-G, which is imitating an alarm call that some birds do. Your non-birders, we like to call them muggles, the non-wizards.
I'm here in Deering Oaks Park in Portland, Maine, to retrace the journey of a bird that made headlines for months. It flew over 2,000 miles from the Amazon jungle and was the first of its kind ever spotted in the U.S. To this day, no one knows how it got here. It all started in late November 2018 when a great black hawk flew into this park, a large public space in the middle of town.
Along this stretch that we're walking right now, kind of during the peak of it, almost as far as we can see around this bend, were just people lined up.
As the news spread, more and more people clamored to see it, peering through binoculars and rushing to take photographs when the bird appeared.
Oh, look, he's got a whole carcass here.
Some people were set up over there, and a guy said, "Oh, come look through my scope. Look at this bird." And it had these, like, sharp golden eyes, and, like, it just looked really commanding.
He looked a little funny. He had really long legs, sort of long, bare legs, I suppose, which is to cool you off when you live in South America.
The city of Portland had to assign a police officer at the park to direct traffic.
So I was driving to the supermarket one day, and I drove by the park, and there were all these people on the street looking at something. So I pulled my car over, and I stopped, and there was
the great black hawk. Because, again, this is the only time this bird's ever been seen in the U.S.
Do you know about the great black hawk? Everybody knew about it.
Facebook, Instagram, social media, eBird. I mean, it flew out of the tree into the park, and, like, everybody picked up their tripods and went running after it.
That's how famous this bird was.
So it was a story for October, November, December, and then into January.
Part of the mystery is how it got here. Unfortunately, the only one who truly knows, the hawk, can't tell us.
If you talk to him, maybe he would say, "Man, I'm glad you asked, because I don't know where I am. Can you direct me home? I'm scared. This place is weird. There's people looking at me."
This is Troy Bennett, a local journalist and musician. He says that if he could talk to the hawk now, he'd ask the question on everyone's mind.
Why? Why were you here?
Before flying into Deering Oaks Park, the hawk was spotted in Biddeford, Maine, and before that, in Texas. But unlike Biddeford and Texas, the hawk stuck around in Portland. It was here for about 2 months.
It came from the Amazon Basin, and it's a species of hawk that does not migrate. So, what is it doing here?
This is Tom, a local taxidermist.
Yeah, I say, well, it's a hawk. It goes where it wants. This one wanted to come up here, so it did. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason. It just did, right?
I've heard people say, you know, someone kidnapped the bird and drove it here.
This is Diane, a bird rescue volunteer.
Is it the polar shift? Is it global change? Is it just because he was wired wrong? You know, I think ultimately there are just more questions than there are answers.
To me, it seemed worth further investigation.
Rachel is a local art student.
Last spring, I did a performance piece inspired by the arrival of the Great Black Hawk. In a different time period, the arrival of an unknown creature would be seen as an omen.
As winter set in, Troy noticed something new in the park.
They were starting to put signs up in the park saying, you know, look out for the hawk. He may be on the ground, and if he is, don't approach him. Call this number.
Then, in late January 2019, there was a big snowstorm.
The great black hawk that made Maine headlines last fall was found by cross-country skiers in Deering Park, unable to stand and lying on the ground.
I got in my car. My husband's like, where are you going? And it's like, the bird is on the ground.
Diane picked up the hawk in a cardboard box and took it to a bird rescue, Avian Haven. When they arrived, the hawk wasn't moving, and she was worried that it wouldn't make it through the night.
The next morning, he was perched. We were just like, oh, yes, you know, this is all going to work out.
But that feeling didn't last for long.
Frostbite is a very insidious process.
It would have lost its feet. And a hawk without feet can't hunt, can't perch, can't grip anything. And so a difficult decision had to be made.
The bird was going to need to be euthanized.
I got up one morning, and the news was that he had passed away.
It's like I started to cry.
When I go by the park, I still think I'm going to see it, even though I know it's not with us anymore.
When the hawk died, tributes began pouring out.
Mainers were heartbroken.
A local company made T-shirts with a picture of the hawk in flight, wings outstretched. The owner of a theater in town wrote a poem that ends with, "I cannot stop my weeping, though you still fly in my mind. I'll never know why you chose the snow, leaving paradise behind." Troy picked up his banjo and wrote a song in memory of the hawk.
"You're the hawk that flew the wrong way. You came and decided to stay. Oh, but how were you to know about the winter's bitter cold? You're the hawk that flew the wrong way."
It lived in Maine. Why was it here? Who knows? Only the hawk knows. However, if it stayed here, it was happy here. It died here. It should remain here. And it should remain here and go in the museum so the people of Maine and around the country can come see it at any time they want.
After the hawk died, a decision was made to have it taxidermied and put on display at the Maine State Museum. For Tom Barraby, it was a great honor to be chosen for this task.
I said that I was more than interested. I would do it for free for the state of Maine and the people of Maine.
This is when I found out about the hawk. Everything else up until this point had happened before I arrived in Portland.
Maine State Museum.
So I went to see the taxidermy because I thought that by seeing it, I would understand why so many people were captivated by this bird.
Hi, I'm Naroli. Nice to meet you.
Dr. Paula Work. I am the curator of systematic collections for the Maine State Museum.
I'm just glad we could make it work. We're going up to the fourth floor.
Thank you. This is like the back room. This is the storage area.
We're going to go straight. This is the registrar's area.
Have you already had requests?
Oh, yeah. People calling on the phone. Is it out yet? Do you have it yet?
Oh, wow.
What do you think?
Honestly, it's smaller than I thought.
Yes.
It looms so large, and I feel like I thought it would be much larger.
We all know stories of the Mona Lisa, that the Mona Lisa grows in your mind. And then if you get to see it in public, in the public viewing space, it's quite small. It's that same sort of dynamic, I think, that's happening with this bird.
Leaving the museum, I felt like I was beginning to understand, but I still didn't quite get it. The taxidermy is not the only way the hawk will live on. Bird rescue volunteer Diane Davison teamed up with the Friends of Deering Oaks Park to raise $28,000 for a life-size bronze statue of the hawk.
people give from the heart in most cases, mm-hmm. and this bird got to many people's hearts.
If all goes according to plan, the statue will be up in the park by summer. Right now, there's only one other statue in Deering Oaks Park, a Spanish war veteran.
The day after I wrote the song, a little shrine appeared on the bridge in the park. There were little paintings and some votive candles burning. And
paintings of the hawk?
Yeah, or of a phoenix, I think it was. Because the symbol of Portland is the phoenix, you know, and our motto is Resurgam, because Portland burned down 3 times.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And it has been rebuilt 3 times.
The day after the hawk died, Troy got a text inviting him to join a gathering at the shrine.
Tomorrow is like Easter morning, and we have a great black phoenix myth that will be born. Join us? They invited me to join this secret Black Hawk Society.
What is it called?
They were called Cult of the Hawk. Oh, there's a phone number here, too. Maybe I'll give you the phone number.
Hi, I'm looking to speak to someone from the Cult of the Hawk.
But it was that guy, Nick Kaufman, who contacted me. And I tried to contact him for Twitter. He hasn't gotten back to me, so.
Hello.
Hi, is this Nick?
After a few weeks, I managed to get hold of Nick.
So when the news came about the hawk dying, this would be when the cult would go into jubilation about the prophecy finally coming to pass.
The hawk is back, and he's in a museum.
That's the resurrection?
Could be, if you look at it right.
Nick had lots of plans for the Cult of the Hawk. A yearly festival, a stage play, and even a Pokemon Go / Great Black Hawk mashup. But in the end, besides the shrine, the Cult of the Hawk mostly lived online as a Facebook page and Twitter handle. Whether online or offline, for Nick and many others, the Great Black Hawk brought people together.
It sort of bonded everybody in a way. You know, definitely like a mascot, like a real mascot that you would protect.
For some, the hawk was an omen of our changing climate. For others, an adventurer forging a new path. For me, it was a chance to connect with the people of Portland. And now I think I get it.
It feels like this is such a small story in some ways, but it also links to such a big, what you're saying is this big human need for meaning and symbols and...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
The Great Black Hawk became a symbol, something for people to take up and rally around, even if they were doing it for different reasons. That is what great mascots do.
You're the hawk that flew the wrong way. You came and decided to stay.
That was Odd Bird, produced by Neroli Price in 2020. It was edited by Livia Brock, featuring music from Troy Bennett, Rachel York, and Chad Crouch. If you would like to pay your respects to the Great Black Hawk yourself, you can actually visit the statue in Portland's Deering Oaks Park, or keep an eye out for updates from the Maine State Museum in Augusta, because the Great Black Hawk will be on display when the museum reopens after a couple of renovations. This is our second-to-last episode. In our final installment, an attempted conversation with a haunting spirit.
Is this captain in the building? No. Is he in the area? Right now I'm getting a no. He's not in the area.
And also a love letter to the many ordinary sounds that become comforting presences in our lives. Thank you so much for listening. We love local storytelling that helps explain the stuff you see around Maine every day. Like, have you ever been walking in the forest and there's just a little rock wall up the trail beside you? Well, we have a video about the history of those little walls. Head to mainepublic.org/storytelling to check out some of our favorite recent pieces. I'm Jess Miller. Essential Salt is produced by Brenna Farrell, with help from Lucy Santerre. Thanks to Isaac Kestenbaum at Salt. Thanks also to Theo Balcom. Our executive producer is Susan Tran. Audio mixing by Stephen Jackson. Essential Salt features original music composed by Q-Shop. You can find more music for storytelling at cue-shop.co. Support for Essential Salt comes from St. Mary's Health System in Lewiston, growing and evolving to best serve the needs of the community since 1888. Learn more at stmarysmaine.com.